Last week, I talked about the experience that Gay and I had in relation to what we believed was God's call to us to serve him in missionary work in Thailand. We move on this morning to talk now about the breaking of the new ground in Thailand, how we got started there. There's not going to be a complete rundown on the whole of our missionary work in Thailand, but I hope again that it's going to be something that will be of benefit to us here, because in many ways, I think as we move through, you'll find that there are some parallels between what we did in Thailand and what's happening here in Mararee in the new work that we've got started. Firstly, a couple of verses from Romans chapter 15. I referred to these couple of verses last week. Paul is talking in Romans 15, verses 19-20. By power of signs and wonders and by the power of the Holy Spirit, I did this and this and this, so that from Jerusalem and as far as Illyricum, I have fully preached the gospel of Christ, thus making it my ambition to preach the gospel not where Christ has already been named, not in any place where Christ is already known, because I don't want to build upon another man's foundation. The main point I want to draw out of that is that Paul was concerned not with going into established works to churches that were already established. He was concerned with going to places where there were no churches and starting them. Now, I'm not saying that every mission he's got to do that, but as far as we were concerned, that was the main consideration in our minds. Now, when we went to Bangkok in the first place, we intended to go to some place where there was not any established work. Now, don't get the idea that there were no other churches in Bangkok. Bangkok is a very big place. In those days, it was about 2 million. These days, it's about 5 million. And there were churches dotted around, but very, very few in relation to the whole city. We wanted to move into a place where there was no church and try to start a church in a place where there was none. Now, as it turned out, we had to spend most of the first 2 years in language study. But during that time, we built up a lot of contacts and we investigated the area. And eventually, we moved into an area of Bangkok where there was, in fact, no church. The area took in between 150 and 200,000 people. And as far as we knew, there were no Christians anywhere there. There was certainly no church, no mission, no missionary, Catholic, Protestant, or anything else in that area. So that's where we moved. Also in the back of our minds when we first went to Bangkok was the idea of working with students to some extent, also helping some of the Christians from other missionary churches, missionary associates and their churches in South Thailand. Sometimes these Christians would come to Bangkok for higher studies, and a lot of them were getting lost in the big cold world, not cold, but the hard cold world, the sleazy world, if you like, the glittering lights of Bangkok. Not all of them, mind you, but we were hoping that we could provide some sort of a church which they would fit into also. Well, it didn't always work out that way. Some of the people we found did fit in, but Bangkok was such a huge place that it was quite unworkable for people who were resident in some place to go hiking halfway across the city simply to go to the particular church we started. Also, although we did draw a lot of contacts from students as time moved on, we by no means concentrated on students. We had a fair cross-section of people that we reached, but students do tend to be far more open than more established older people who are fairly dyed-in-the-wool and less inclined to think of alternative ideas. But as things developed, we found that our work didn't really concentrate on any particular group. Now, that's all sort of by way of introduction. I better go back to the start. We came from Australia, both of us, from a very active church background, involved in the usual things, you know, Sunday schools and youth groups and clubs and preaching and ladies' meetings and men's meetings and all sorts of other meetings and all the paraphernalia that goes to make up an established church. That was largely what was in our mind when we went to Bangkok. We thought, well, we'll sort of do the same thing here, start a Sunday school, start a youth group, start this, start something else. But as I say, we had quite a while in language study when we weren't really able to do a lot, apart from contact a few of these Christian friends from South Thailand, but we weren't able really to do very much in the way of evangelism or church planting in new areas. But we were able to do a lot in study of the Bible. Now, most of our time, probably 10 hours a day, was spent in language study. But as we went back to read the Bible, particularly the book of Acts, we started to rethink a lot of things. Sunday schools, youth groups, we didn't see them in the book of Acts. That doesn't mean to say they're wrong. It just means to say that you don't have to have them in order to start a church. Other things that we are used to, our form of service, the way we do things, our established churches, our church buildings, our meetings on Sunday, midweek, and all the other activities that we have. When we looked at the book of Acts, we didn't see them there. And so we tended to drop off, one by one, all the preconceived ideas we had concerning what a church should be and how it should function. And as we looked at the church in Acts, I say the church in Acts because that's how the church grew. In the first chapter of Acts, you've got the ascension of Jesus, and then the small group of Christians meet together. It starts off with only about 120 Christians in Jerusalem. And then in chapter 2, they preach, and a lot more believe. And then as you move through, there's more believe. And then the church leaves Jerusalem and expands into other places. It shifts out into the regions beyond, so to speak. And as we looked at how the church developed from those very small beginnings, it caused us to rethink the way we would go about things. Now, we wanted the church to be independent, so we didn't start all the activities. We didn't even start a Sunday school. Not that I think there's anything wrong with that, but I didn't want to start a whole lot of activities that would have depended upon us to run them. We didn't want to start things that would depend on our expertise, our finances, our know-how, because we wanted the church to be its own church, to be its own thing, and not to be something that was hung around our necks or dependent upon us. Later on, if they wanted to start a Sunday school, well, they could. When they felt they were sufficiently developed, well, fair enough, let them start it themselves. But we didn't start all these things. So we simply started by getting to know a few people. And that's, I think, where it starts in the book of Acts. Let's start in chapter 1, verse 8. And what I'm going to do through this talk is look through probably a dozen or so references. We're going to skip through the book of Acts. And I'm going to look at how the church grew very briefly. And I'm going to relate this to our own experience in Bangkok. In chapter 1, verse 8, you shall receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you shall be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. A witness is one who speaks about what he has seen and known. Originally, in this verse, the witness meant a witness to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. These people had actually seen him, and they were going to go and tell everybody that Christ was alive. Now, the word witness has become something of a technical word in Christian circles, meaning going out and talking to other people, person to person, about Jesus Christ. Now, that, of course, is involved too. But a witness is a person who testifies to what he knows to be the truth. And it's done on a person-to-person basis as a rule. So we simply started to get to know people, and hopefully to move out from our friends and neighbours into ever-widening circles, as we have it there in verse 8 of Acts 1. The ever-widening circles from Jerusalem to the surrounding territory of Judea to the neighbouring province of Samaria, and so it goes on and on until it's reached the ends of the earth. Now, it was in the course of doing this and getting a few people interested, I didn't really find anything in Thai language that, to me, was suitable for these people who knew nothing about Christianity. And that's when I first wrote a simple little thing called The Christian's Faith that hopefully would get the essence of the matter across and form some sort of contact point with people. As you know, that grew eventually into those five little booklets, The Christian's Faith, Christian's Bible, Christian's God, and so on. But that's how it all started as we tried to make these contacts. Well, we made lots of contacts. We started groups. A group might have only been two people or three people, sometimes in the home of the person or in our own home, or where the person worked. We had a group at the police barracks, had another one at the hospital, had another one at the university, and so it went on. These little groups of people trying to explain to them what Christianity was about. Now, most of those people didn't become Christians, but a few of them did. So when they became Christians, we then moved on and kept on teaching the Bible to them, and of course, we baptized them. That's what Jesus said. You go and you make disciples of people and you baptize them. And so baptism is a very essential part of our Christian testimony. That is the way Jesus wants us to declare our faith. And so we baptize them. You find that as you move through chapter 2 of Acts now, where Peter said to these people, repent and be baptized. That's in verse 38. And in verse 41 it says, those who received his word were baptized. So we baptize those who received the word, those who believed. Sometimes we just baptize them in the local park, which was not very far from our house. That was in the very early days, but then later on when we moved into this other area that I mentioned where we really concentrated our work, we baptized them in the river, which was again quite nearby. Now these new Christians, what happens to them when they have believed and been baptized? Well, the next verse, chapter 2, verse 42, says they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and prayers. I know that that verse has been rather overworked by some people, but I do believe that that verse contains the essentials of what church life is about. Just look at them again. Firstly, there's the apostles' teaching. And so we taught them. We started with the book of Acts, then we got them reading the Gospels, and we moved on to Romans, and Corinthians to get the basics of Christian life and practice. How does the church function? What do Christians believe? And so equip them book by book in a knowledge of the New Testament and then to the Old Testament. And that, by the way, is how I got involved in writing those New Testament books and ultimately the Old Testament books. But of course that was spread out over the next 10 years. But that's where it all started, through teaching these people. So you teach them the basic teachings. There's the fellowship. Fellowship is essential. We get together regularly for fellowship. Breaking of bread, the Lord's Supper or communion. Communion means fellowship, and we have fellowship with each other, not simply in having a barbecue or going on a picnic or visiting each other for tea and biscuits, but we have fellowship really in sharing together in the elements of bread and wine, which of course symbolize Jesus Christ our Lord, who gave himself for us. And so as we are partaken of him by faith, so jointly we worship together and commune with him and with each other through the Lord's Supper. And so we used to meet together then on Sundays for fellowship and the breaking of bread, and of course the other mention there is prayers. Essential part of any church is prayer. Prayer of worship, prayers of praise, but also prayers of request that God will bless our work and make it fruitful, that we'll reach more people for Christ and see the church growing. Now one of the big problems is that so many churches have taken that verse 42 as a guide as to what they should do, but then they spend so much of their time arguing about how you do this and how you do that, that they very rarely get round to actually doing the things they're supposed to do. That's what happens here in the West, in our home churches. People are so strung up over the procedures, the methodology, and if you step out of line, before you know where you are, you've got yourself an argument with somebody, because we don't do it that way in this church. As far as I can see, the Bible tells us very little about how to do these things. It doesn't tell us how to arrange our chairs, whether we've got to stand up, sit down, or turn around when we pray, how many songs we're to sing. Are we to sing our songs and prayers and sermons all sort of mingled up together? Or do we have a slab of songs and a slab of prayers and a slab of teaching? Or do we participate various people, or does one person participate prominently? Who leads and how do they lead, or what type of format our service is going to follow? All those issues, the Bible really doesn't give us anything definite at all. It does not set out to be a handbook on church practice or church procedure. It gives us the basics, and we, in our own context, have to work out what is the way to do those things. Now, there are some guidelines. You do meet from time to time, Paul says. For example, he doesn't want everybody talking at once. That's one thing he says. You know, simple things like that. What you say must be for edification. If you're going to gabble on and nobody understands what you're saying, he said, I don't want that. So we've got these guidelines, but when it comes to the mundane organisation of our order of service, how we arrange our seats or our music or our musical instrument or whether we stand or whatever we do, you know, all those sorts of things, really, we work it out ourselves. And so we left it to the church to work out these things as it moved along. The main thing is to make sure that we do devote ourselves to the teaching of the word, that we do meet for fellowship, that we do observe the Lord's Supper, and that we do pray together, and that we do witness and reach out into the regions round about. We kept teaching these people in the small groups. When they became Christians, we kept on this person-to-person type of instruction. It's very difficult to get people together midweek in Thailand. They don't have the sort of formalized working hours that we have here. It's really chaotic. Even Sundays, it's very difficult for a lot even to get time off on Sundays to come to church. So we only really had the one combined service that was on Sundays, and then during the week it was a case of many little groups, up to a dozen of them per week around the place. Some with Christians, some with non-Christians. But you organize the church as you go. You find that's what happened in the New Testament. When you came across to chapter 6, you find that there was a problem arose in the church because they had a plan to distribute food equally among all the people in the congregation. They shared their goods. I'm not quite sure that it was a brilliant idea, because it seems to me that they dissipated their capital rather too quickly, and soon they were in dire straits. They were a bit poverty-stricken. But one good thing that came out of it was that they catered for the poor among them, which is something we ought to take notice of. But it soon developed that there was a problem, an ethnic problem really. Some Jews, although they were Jews, didn't speak the Jewish language, and there was a feeling of some being first-class Jews and some second-class Jews because they couldn't speak their mother tongue. And a certain degree of friction developed between these two groups. And to make sure that there was even-handed justice in the daily distribution of food, the apostles, who were really the sort of prototype elders, they were the leaders of the church in Jerusalem. There was only one church at this stage, the one in Jerusalem. They said, why not appoint seven men who can look after this work. And so they chose seven men who met certain qualifications, and they of course became the prototype deacons that we meet later on, the servants of the church, who looked after many of the daily ministrations of the church. But the point I'm just making here is that they made the development when the need was there. They didn't come in with a format and say, this is going to be our constitution, this is going to be the way we run things, and now we're going to make the church fit into this framework. It worked the other way around. You start with the people, and you let the framework develop as the people's needs developed. Here was a need, and so they appointed these men to meet the need. Well, likewise, as I said with us, we just started with the people. We didn't say, you must have a Sunday school youth group, Sunday morning service, Sunday evening service, and midweek prayer meeting. We didn't start off like that. We started simply with the people. We met just on Sunday morning for the fellowship teaching, prayer and worship. But then as they felt they could develop, well, so they did. And that's how the Sunday school started. We took them along to Child Evangelism Fellowship, which is a little bit like Scripture Union. They have training courses and so on for teachers. But you see, it was theirs. Gay and I never had anything to do with the Sunday school. It was theirs from the beginning. It was something they did. Now that's the point that I'm getting at. We let the thing develop as they feel that they can do those things. Not something we're imposing upon them, but something that the locals develop themselves. Well, you move on now to chapter 8, and you find that the great way in which Christianity spread was by word of mouth. I'm still convinced that that is the best way for the message to spread. With all our mass media, with all the facilities available to us through satellite communications, television, radio, printing press, and you name it, we've got it. In spite of all that, I'm still convinced that the most effective way the message of Jesus Christ spreads is through us, as we talk with people face to face. Because ultimately a person's got to come to a personal understanding of Jesus Christ. There's got to be that personal contact if a person is to be saved. So we really have to deal with them as people. And that's how it spread in the New Testament church. They spread much more rapidly than we do today, even though they had none of our facilities. And a lot of people were only semi-literate or even illiterate. Yet it spread rapidly because people went out and told others. You come to chapter 8, and persecution broke out when one of the Christians was murdered by a group of fanatical Jews. The Jews now turned against the Christians, and many of the Christians had to flee for their lives. In fact, they were chased out of Jerusalem by the fanatical Jews. But in verse 4 it tells us that those who were scattered went about preaching the word. And so wherever they went, they preached it. Philip, it says, went to Samaria. So you can see now how the comment that we saw in chapter 1, going to Jerusalem, then Judea, then Samaria, you see now how that is being fulfilled, how it's coming to fruition. The story goes on there to talk about how it spread into this place and that place. And some people that become Christians become very prominent Christians. In all the nations round about, up in Syria, in Damascus, over in the island of Cyprus, down in northern parts of Egypt, you find there are communities of Christians starting to develop because those who left Jerusalem went and preached the message. And as I say, some of those Christians become very prominent. And one of them we meet in chapter 9, a man called Paul. In chapter 9, verse 15, it says of Paul, the Lord has chosen him. He's an instrument of mine, says the Lord, to carry my name before the Gentiles and kings and the sons of Israel. Paul is the one that God has chosen to be his special ambassador, to take the message far and wide in a way that no other would achieve. Paul had a tremendous vision for the world. And unlike most of his fellow Jews, he was very broad-minded and very internationally minded. Most of the Jews were very parochial. They sat around and were concerned only for the Jews' interests. But Paul was one who was concerned very much for the interests of the non-Jews. And he is the one who is most remembered for making the tremendous thrust into the non-Jewish regions of the world. You see how God has his use for special people. We found as the church was growing that certain people became prominent. I think of two in particular. One of them was a man who developed considerable ability at simply expounding the scriptures. And he developed a real pastor's heart. He was in fact the first person that we baptized. And it turned out that he was one who really did become a true pastor and a teacher. And to this day, he is still the backbone of the church. I have met very few people, English speakers or any other language speakers, who have the ability to expound very simply and in a practical way the scriptures. The second man I think of is one who became a very fervent evangelist. I don't know of anybody who has the ability to communicate with others about the gospel as effectively as this man can. He brought in lots of contacts. Wherever he went, he seemed to just have that knack of walking up to a person cold almost, and in no time he's got the person drawn into a conversation about Christianity. When you come to chapter 11, you find that there are a number of conservatives in the church who really resist these Gentiles coming into the church without first conforming to the traditional Jewish pattern. And so there's quite a conflict. You see it in chapter 11, verse 2. Some of the strict Jews criticize Peter because he went and ate with non-Jewish people and did not follow the ordinary taboos of Jewish dietary habits and so forth. Now that became quite a problem in the church. But the problem only arose because these people could not adjust themselves to see that people of different culture may do things in a different way, and there is no basic principle which is threatened. It's simply some tradition that we've followed, and we think that's the only way it can be done, and we don't realize sometimes that there is no requirement in the Bible at all that we should do it that way. So we've got to be relaxed and not get uptight as soon as somebody does something a different way from the way we've normally done it. And that happened in the church. There were many things that they wanted to do that weren't exactly the way I'd do things, but that's okay. It's their church, not mine. And again, as long as no fundamental principle is involved, as long as no wrong is done, a difference of taste in this or that is something we've just got to learn to live with. But the real development in the early church came in chapter 11, verse 19, concerning certain Jews who travelled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus and Antioch. Many of these had preached to only the Jews, it says in verse 19, but on verse 20, there were some of them who, when they came to Antioch, preached to the Greeks as well. And now we have a wholesale evangelization, you might say, of non-Jewish people. Up until now, this spread of the church had largely been confined among Jewish people. But these people who come to Antioch in Syria completely break with that tradition, and here they are speaking with the Greeks as well. And in verse 21, a great number believe. News of this in verse 22 comes to the church in Jerusalem, and they send Barnabas to have a look at what's going on. Barnabas was very pleased with what he saw, and he then went and got Saul, who we call Paul, from Tarsus, to come and help him, because he saw the church was growing rapidly and it really needed some help. And so the two of them then, in verse 26, stayed there for the next year, and they taught a whole company of people, and that church in Antioch grew and grew and grew. And that's the place where Christians first got the name Christian, in Antioch in Syria. Now the point that comes out of this is that that church was so strong and so healthy because of the balance that there was between outreach and upbuilding. And by that I mean, it wasn't just a church that gathered on Sunday to sit around and pray and sing songs to God. Sure, it met on Sunday for worship and prayer and fellowship and teaching, but it also went out and reached other people. So you find a large company, it says, is added to the Lord, lots and lots of converts, but also they're teaching a large company in the church. So more and more people are being reached with the gospel, more and more people are being built up in the church. And any church which is going to be healthy must have that balance between outreach and upbuilding. And sometimes it may need outside help. We may not have the gifts within us to handle the situation. We may need to invite somebody to come and be an evangelist or a pastor among us. Take up residence among us for a while to do the work. So it was here that they got Paul to come and help. Well, now it didn't so happen that we needed that while I was there, but I certainly think that since I've left, although the church is to be given full credit for the way they've carried on, they have got a deficiency in that they don't have a person who can spend the amount of time in some of these things that I was able to spend. Most people in the church have jobs just like you do, and you've got to go to work, and although they're enthusiastic for the Lord, they simply do not have the time to devote to the outreach and upbuilding that they would like. But chapter 13 brings us to another development where we find out that this church in Antioch becomes the jumping off place for the evangelization of Asia Minor and ultimately Europe. At the end of verse 3 it says of Barnabas and Saul that the church now sent them off as their missionaries. Now that's one of the things I've been drumming into the people, that it wasn't good enough for the church simply to sit there and say, we are God's people, isn't that marvellous? No, the church had to outreach, it had to evangelize, it had to go out into the people round about. Well, my great disappointment came when this chap that I mentioned earlier, who was the most enthusiastic evangelist, a fellow by the name of Jun, he then decided he would go and start a church in his own province. I've just got things a little bit out of order here. I should have mentioned that at this time we appointed elders. Now that's going to be referred to in the next chapter of Acts, but it's necessary for the church to have its own eldership. And by this time, gift had developed in the church, responsibility had shown itself, and the two men that I mentioned, Chua, who was the teacher, pastor type of person that I mentioned earlier, Jun, who's the enthusiastic evangelist type of person, they were the two people that first of all I appointed as leaders in the church. Well, imagine my disappointment when Jun came one day and said he believed God would have him go back to his own province. I was trying like mad to persuade him to stay, but he says, but wait a minute, he said, you've been telling us and we've been going through Acts that you've got to reach out and you've got to go into the unreached areas, he says, and there's those people back there. So I had no answer to him really. I guess it was selfish on my part that I wanted to keep him because he was such a valuable member of the church. But in full fellowship with us, he went back and the church has maintained its contact. In fact, we have a very close interest. We have a lot of interchange between the church that he got started in his hometown of Ganjanumbri and our church in Bangkok. And the church sends him gifts of money from time to time to help him. That's another thing that develops. In chapter 11, we find the church in Antioch sent a gift of money to the church in Jerusalem. And so even though each church is independent of the other, there is a link of fellowship between them. And so just as the church in Antioch sent money to help the Christians in Jerusalem, so our church in Bangkok, we started to send money to help Jun and some of the Christians in Ganjanumbri. Because he went back there, he put into practice the things that he had come to learn in Bangkok, and soon the church was going there as well. But that was quite a blow to us. But we've got to learn not to be selfish and above all not to be ingrown. Now one of the dangers this little church here has is that because we're new, we're just getting going, and we're enthusiastic, that we'll become ingrown, that we'll be concerned for our own area. We are concerned for our own area, and it's terrific to see all the people that are in our circle of interest, the number of contacts we have, the number of people involved through our different outreach activities and so on. But let's realize that there is a bigger world out there beyond the borders of Murarrie and Cannon Hill. There's a bigger world, and there are unreached areas where people haven't yet even had the opportunities that we've had to know about Jesus Christ. We've got to be concerned for those as well. Young churches ought never to become ingrown. There's an old saying, the light that shines farthest shines brightest. And I'd like our light to shine a long way and go into other countries too, as did the church in Antioch. Chapter 14, verse 23, refers to the appointment of elders. Paul had been travelling around. You know this story, we've been through our studies in Acts, so you've sort of got the general drift of what's happening. Paul had been travelling around, and he had planted churches in different towns of Asia Minor. And when he visited them the second time in verse 23, he appointed elders in every church with prayer and fasting, and committed them to the Lord in whom they believed. Ultimately, the church has got to run itself. And we had been working towards this goal. Now, we had told the Christians that we'd be there about 4.5 years in our first stint on the mission field. We wanted that church to be strong, and so strong that it would go by itself when we went away. We didn't want to call in relief missionaries or someone to sit in the chair while we were away. We wanted them to stand on their own feet. And so we were working towards that goal, and of course that was part of the reason why we appointed elders, as I've just mentioned, that the church would have its own leadership and would be autonomous. And by the time that we did come home on our first leave, the church had 18 people in it then. I think none of those, if I can remember correctly, virtually none of them anyway, was more than 4 years old as a Christian. They were fairly new Christians. Now, there was a danger that they could have problems or sink, but it was a case of sink or swim. And they did have a few problems, but they didn't sink. The church did swim, and so we were able to come back after our first leave at home and find the church still ticking away, and it had learned a few things in the meantime. It continued to grow, just if I can skip through a few things here before I come back to Acts. It did continue to grow. We got more involved in writing this material so that the amount of work I did in evangelism wasn't as great as previously, as we're trying now to equip the church better to do its work itself. And so I concentrated more and more on getting these Old Testament, New Testament books written, and then later on, of course, the Bible dictionary and other material. Eventually, we came home and left the church by itself, and by that time, the church had about 25, 30 people. We seemed to get to a stage where, as quick as we got our new people, we lost others. Some of them just fell by the wayside, and others moved into other parts of Thailand in activities of different sort, occupational work or whatever. And some of them have made a great impression in the places they've been. They've got very involved in other aspects of Christian service. And the church continued to see two or three people converted, baptized, and brought into the fellowship each year. But coming back to the appointment of elders, it's necessary a church have elders so that it can be autonomous, self-governing, and responsible for its own life and activity. That's chapter 14. Well, you come along now, and Paul's journeys go on and on. Come to chapter 17. The only point I want to make here is that the length of time a missionary stays in a town will vary. There's no rule that you must be there 3 years or 30 years. We've got no way of knowing why it is that sometimes a church gets going quickly and sometimes a church takes a long time to get going. There may be many reasons, but there is no rule of thumb. There's nothing automatic about this. Paul realized that in chapter 17 of Acts, verse 2. He goes to Thessalonica and he argues in the synagogue for 3 weeks. But soon after that, we find he has to leave. Yet, he left behind a church. So he wasn't there very long at all. But when you come to chapter 18, verse 11, in Corinth, he was there 1 year and 6 months. It took a lot longer to get that church going. When you come to Ephesus later on, he was there 3 years getting it going. You see, there's no automatic way of guaranteeing what's happening. But the point I'm making is this, that always Paul planned to move on. He never planned to be there indefinitely. He always had this goal of planting the church, getting it strong, and then moving on. It would take some time before he could move on. But that was his goal. His goal was never to be there indefinitely. He was elastic. He was flexible when it came to how long he was going to stay in different places. You come to chapter 19, concerning Ephesus, where he spent 3 years. We find that the church then became the center from which the whole place was evangelized, the whole region. In verse 8, he was in the synagogue for 3 months, but in verse 9 he was forced to leave and he went with some of his disciples and hired the lecture hall of Tyrannus. And in verse 10, this continued for 2 years. So he had a 2-year course where he taught the people every day, and it says, all the residents of Asia heard the word of the Lord. Now we know that Paul himself did not go into many of the different parts of Asia. He says so. But yet all of Asia heard the word. How did they hear it? They heard it through these disciples that Paul had trained, and they took the message. And so you see again that the church is there as a center from which the surrounding region can be evangelized. Paul had a strategy, but the strategy was not wooden. It wouldn't work unless the quality of the Christians was sufficient to guarantee that their word would spread. There's no automatic method that you can follow. Paul moved along the great highways, planting churches in the main towns so that from those towns the word would spread into the surrounding region. Well, that was a good idea, but it would only work if the Christians in those churches were strong and enthusiastic. And so that's why he spends this time in Ephesus teaching these people. We find they are strong and enthusiastic, and they do go out and spread the news round about. So Paul moved on in ever-widening circles. We read last week about how he said to the people in Corinth, I want to preach the Gospels in the regions beyond. But first of all, I want to make sure how you're stable. When you're stable, then I'll move further west into Italy and then ultimately into Spain. Always moving on. But you notice also that he did revisit the churches. You come to chapter 20, verse 3, and we find here that he spent 3 months in Greece revisiting the church that we've just referred to in Corinth. The church in Ephesus we've just referred to, he revisited that. And even though he went into other areas, he always found time to go and revisit the churches and to continue to strengthen those Christians. Even though the churches were established and strong and governing themselves and standing on their own feet, there was still a work for Paul to do in helping those Christians. And so it is that from time to time we've had the opportunity of going back to Bangkok, helping through writing of books, but helping through visits and being there for a few months, contributing something to the ongoing growth and stability of the work. Well, there it is, a very brief rundown of breaking the new ground, evangelizing in places where there are previously no Christians, getting a church going, and then seeing how the church can go on and grow and expand, and hopefully be the jumping off point for other churches round about. That's the way it was in Acts, and certainly I hope that that's the way it's going to be among us here at Murarrie.